Okay, today's guest, Rick Doblin, put me on hold. What was that all about?
that was a call from a Dr. Ken Alper in New York City, and he's been a prominent researcher in the area of Ibogaine for the treatment of substance abuse. Ibogaine is a psychedelic drug from Western Africa in Gabon. It's used for religious purposes by the Bwiti religion. But what he called to tell me about was, like, astoundingly hilarious. He's been trying to get a grant to do the research from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And they replied to him that Ibogaine is marginal, and it will always remain so, and that part of their evidence that Ibogaine is marginal is that MAPS has never supported clinical research with Ibogaine. So what? NIDA is using MAPS as a reference. It's just shocking. And it's also typical of NIDA, because for the past 10 years, we've been trying to do Ibogaine research. We've recently put out a $25,000 matching grant to try to do clinical studies with Ibogaine. We're reviewing a protocol right now. So they got it totally wrong that we're not interested in Ibogaine. But the fact that they would refer to us as kind of like an authority on what's relevant is just hilarious. I mean, because we're now involved in massive legal case against NIDA's monopoly on marijuana for medical use.
Oh, this is perfect. I'm going to go right into our intro right now. Okay. And this world really is so nonlinear. And let's get with the program here. Now we will get a little linear and go into the way I usually start the program, okay?
Okay, and then we'll go back to nonlinear.
Exactly. Perfect. Okay.
Okay.
Stand by. I wanted to respond to the interviews I've done with the three atheists who, after having one session with the entheogen 5-MeO, became full-on believers in God. 5-MeO is either extracted from the Sonoran Desert toad or created in a lab, and as an entheogen, falls into the category of a psychedelic or mind-altering substance. Rick Doblin, today's guest, created the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies in 1986. Known as MAPS, they sponsor clinical trials to develop MDMA, also known as ecstasy, and other psychedelics, including ibogaine and marijuana, into prescription medication. Oh, and did I mention that he received college credits for suing the DEA? I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Well, welcome.
Yes, Robin. I'm so glad to be with you today.
Okay.
For other things.
Okay, first we need the Reader's Digest version of college credits for suing the FDA. I'm sure you're already in hero status with a lot of our audience.
For suing DEA, you mean?
The DEA, yes.
And NIDA. Well, I should say also that I have a master's and a PhD from Harvard, from the Kennedy School of Government, but that my college credit for suing DEA was from my when I was just an undergraduate at New College of Florida, which is the Honors College of the State of Florida. And you can sort of do independent study and make up classes. And so I worked with the head of the political science department. And this was in 1984 and 85, when the development of MDMA, which was sort of a quiet drug used from the middle 70s to the early 80s as adjunct to psychotherapy and to personal growth, and about 500,000 doses were used in those settings. And then some of the people that used it thought that, this was a great marketing opportunity and people should have this experience, and they renamed it ecstasy. And then it became used in more public settings. And starting in 1984, the DEA tried to criminalize MDMA, and not just criminalize its recreational use, but its therapeutic use as well. And I had been working for a couple years at that point with this group of therapists, psychiatrists that were operating as if MDMA were illegal, even though it wasn't, keeping the use of it quiet, because the fear was, in the buildup of the Nancy Reagan Just Say No, that once people heard about it, that they would criminalize it. And so starting in 1984, when the DEA moved to criminalize it, they had to put something in the Federal Register, which announced their intention 30 days later to criminalize it. And I worked with the psychiatrists, psychologists, and others, and I went to Washington, D.C., and worked with some lawyers, and walked into the DEA office and filed this lawsuit that completely and totally shocked them, because they had only known of MDMA as ecstasy, and they had no knowledge of this therapeutic use that was really quite strong. And
that's incredible.
In there with, you know, doctors, psychiatrists from Harvard Medical School, prominent psychiatrists, psychologists from all over the country, and it just really set them spinning. And I was able to get college credit for it. It's great.
Well, bravo. That's amazing. Did you find that it was amazing they didn't even know about its therapeutic uses at that time?
Well, you know, we tend to think of the government as this omnipotent force that knows everything. And, you know, for people who work inside the government, that's hilarious. You know, they are human and they make all sorts of mistakes. And so it wasn't all that surprising, because the people that were using the therapeutic use of MDMA, you know, had just... many of them had seen the crackdown, the backlash that took place after the 60s that eliminated all over the world one of this enormously promising areas of research. And so they were appropriately cautious about this new tool, MDMA, that had been developed that had such unique and remarkable therapeutic properties. And so it was really kept quiet and done, you know, indoor settings, non-public settings, not at bars. You know, it was done in a way where it wouldn't necessarily come to the attention of the DEA. And at the same time, MDMA has a lot of built-in safeguards pharmacologically that make it unlikely that people who use it in those kind of contexts will have frightening experiences or physically dangerous experiences.
How is that possible? What could be built in?
Well, it just happens that the molecule, well, first off, when we talk about psychedelic drugs, most people think about LSD or mushrooms, and they think about these incredible visuals, and they think about a whole different sort of psychedelic way of processing. And we see it a lot in the movies now. You sort of are going through this wormhole-type tunnel, and you know things are flashing by. And that is often the way it is with, you know, classic psychedelics. But MDMA doesn't really affect perceptions very much at all. And so, you know, people's hold on reality, in a sense, is not really shattered. At the same time, the ego, the frame of reference that we use to observe the world and sort of mediate who we think we are, that the classic psychedelics break that up. It's like your normal way of processing information is sort of the filters are taken off, you're flooded with material. And that's where a lot of unconscious material comes up and things that people have been trying to suppress or deny, and then, you know, you can work with it that way. But with MDMA, it really doesn't change much in the way of your logical way of processing. People are opened up emotionally, and their fear about difficult emotions is reduced, and they can handle looking at traumatic experiences, which is why it's so useful in post-traumatic stress disorder, but also people can handle sort of emotionally charged situations in terms of relationships, romance. You know, people become better listeners, but it doesn't fundamentally challenge the hold on reality, so it doesn't develop much in the way of panic reactions, although it's not impossible, but it rarely happens. And then at the same time, you know, perhaps many of the listeners have heard about people who, you know, dance all night at these raves and overheat and die, and that is a risk of MDMA, but it's a risk under certain circumstances. It's a rare, you know, one in several million risk, but in a therapeutic context where people are not dancing all night, that particular risk doesn't happen.
Now I see why the Methodists would not allow dancing.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked actually with some Zen, highly trained, lifelong Zen meditators who also, the Zen tradition tends to be not very sympathetic to psychedelics, but actually a lot of the Zen people are very psychedelicized. And so there's this one group that has been combining Zen meditation, sitting Zen meditation, with ecstatic dance throughout the course of a meditation retreat or throughout the course of a long night on MDMA, and they'll end up meditating, and then, you know, there's this walking meditation, but this is more like dancing.
Right. Well, the Zulus created an entire society on that, on the ecstatic dancing, for sure. But that's another story.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, I think what that points out is that there are a lot of ways to access these sort of ecstatic states or communal bonding states.
And
dance is one of the tried and true ways for thousands of years, and that psychedelics have often been combined with the dance, but that what we're talking about is not sort of psychedelic experiences, but we're talking about profound human experiences that people are able to access in any number of different ways. And so I think that changes, you know, we have this word that I never use, hallucinogen, to describe these substances, MDMA again being, you know, profoundly different because it doesn't really cause much in the way of visual disturbances. But there's something about hallucination as a term that implies that it's a delusion, it's not real, it's somehow or other distorted and twisted, whereas the word psychedelic means mind manifesting, much in the same way as dreams. You know, and things, when they come out in dreams, they're coded, they're symbolic, they're, you know, they're not quite normally the way we see things, but that there is a certain kind of internal validity to them. I think things that come up during MDMA in particular are even less symbolic sometimes than MDMA, than dreaming. But that it's a human experience. It's not a drug experience. And I think once we can understand that and come to grips with that, then our whole prohibition on these drugs starts to seem like prohibition against the human spirit, against finding out who we really are.
Right. Yes. I think it's important right now to bring up, and also an interesting fact, that if you take someone like a very conscious, meditated guru type person, or yogi rather than guru, or someone who has reached consciousness and made a practice of that, they can take a psychedelic and not have any shift go on because they're already living in that space.
Well, that's a question. I mean, that is sort of the Ram Dass story about going to see his guru in India, and, you know, he took a bunch of LSD and nothing happened. So I believe that that's conceivably possible. But I think that for most people, and it often is the case for people who are spiritual and meditating, that they're actually not balanced and that they are overvaluing this kind of spiritual unitive experience and undervaluing the human struggle and the human side of their personality. So Alan Watts is one of the people who we think of as sort of bringing in Zen to the Western world, and he was an alcoholic. Soonyang Trungpa, who started Naropa Institute, was similarly an alcoholic. So I think there's a danger in overvaluing this kind of sort of removed spirituality that's disconnected from social justice,
right,
and from working in the world. And so I think that many spiritual leaders who would take LSD, which kind of activates the, you know, all parts of them, including sort of what they've suppressed. So I think it's unlikely that there's very many people that, no matter how spiritual they are, take a bunch of LSD and like, oh, nothing happened.
Okay, well said. And
yeah,
I think there are the individuals.
I don't want to raise doubts on Ram. Well, I guess I do. I mean, I have some doubts about Ram Dass's story as well.
Right. Okay, but my point in saying that was that there are people, and maybe they are the ones that are under the radar, that are very integrated with their spirituality. And
yes,
they are in the world, yet not of it. So anyway, that's all I want to say about that.
Yeah, there are people like that. But I've been amazed, in a way, how many of sort of, you know, spiritually adept people who represent their different traditions have still found that they can learn from psychedelics.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Well said. So taking a historic perspective, We're definitely at a juncture in time and space where it seems spirit and emotions are coming out of the closet to perhaps stay in step with human intellect. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on that with the emotional and spiritual link to this lagging situation or desire to really, like, feels like it needs to come out of the closet, I guess.
Well, I think you put your finger exactly on it, because we as humans, we as a culture, are overdeveloped intellectually and technologically and underdeveloped emotionally and spiritually. And it's reached a point where the dangers are so great to the whole human species that this imbalance causes, that we have the technology that is polluting the world, that is causing global warming, that is built these enormous weapons of mass destruction, and yet we have these, you know, wars based on, you know, my God's the only right God and your God is wrong, and you know, and there's so much racism and prejudice and fear that this disconnect is really imperiling our survival as a species and even a lot of life on the planet. If you look at all of the extinctions that are going on, so that this time, I think, is so important at bringing about more of a balance between this intellectual technological development and this, you know, emotional spiritual development. And so into that is coming sort of a psychedelic renaissance. There's more research going on with psychedelics now than at any time in the last 40 years. Even still, what's going on now isn't quite as much. There was an enormous amount, an explosion of research in the 50s and 60s, thousands of researchers and studies all over the world really cracking the code of brain chemistry and understanding serotonin. A lot of the whole understanding of the serotonin system came from looking at LSD.
I know. It's so beautiful how these things happen, because everyone, you know, what comes up initially is a huge threat or fear. And then look at all of the side avenues that have opened up from that. And just as, you know, you talk about the extinctions that are going on and what some people might claim is happening with global warming and all of these things, it's like, it's really, you know, it's like with the presidents also, you know, people say, oh, he's doing terrible things. But in a way, I say bring it on, because the more obviously terrible things are, the quicker they're going to change for the better.
Well, that's a question, because what we found with MDMA in therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder is that there's this optimal window of arousal, so that many of the non-drug approaches to therapy with PTSD, which involve one of them called prolonged exposure, where you kind of help people relive the trauma and talk about it till they kind of get
ad nauseam
to it, is that some significant percentage of people, the fear becomes too great, and then they can't deal with it. And then on the other side, people become emotionally numb, which also makes them not in this optimal window of arousal for therapeutic benefit, so that people can get paralyzed with fear. So this idea of, you know, things get worse and worse, it's there's this window that really we have to try to work within and to recognize that being numb doesn't work, or being too hyper-aroused and scared, people just freeze. And that's where the power of MDMA is so necessary and helpful, in that it works on the fear-based centers of the brain. And it permits people to deal with material that previously would have just caused them to freeze up or to just totally numb out and disassociate. And with MDMA, people can look more carefully and feel more deeply and understand in a more comprehensive manner, so that when the MDMA session is over, and again, our whole therapy is based on a combination of the psychedelic experience and then non-drug psychotherapy to help both prepare and then fundamentally to help people integrate it, that you can remember the incident in a more complex neural pattern afterwards. And so the fear-based triggers no longer work to trigger the fears, but you get this more complex understanding. That was then. Not everybody's like that. I've learned some lessons. I can protect myself more so. So I think there's, I think there are good things in a sense to this, you know, global warming, to the recognition that many people in our world are having that the crises are you know, getting larger and that we need to develop some response. It's harder and harder to deny what's going on. And on the one hand, though, if you look at this retreat to fundamentalism, which is going on in a lot of religions.
Do I have to look at that?
Well, we can maybe look at it for a very brief period
okay,
of time.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, it's that, again, it's that fear-based reaction. You got all these people that previously, in a way, you could say, even lived in isolated religious contexts. They weren't exposed to all these other approaches to the world. So it was easier to say, my way is the right way, and it's the only right way. But then you find out, wow, look at this. There's thousands of religions, and they all have different approaches.
Right.
And so part of a response is for people to retreat to this sort of stronger fundamentalism. I mean, we see that with, you know, the denial of evolution and all different ways in which people do that retreat. But that's because they're really losing their grip on their ability to make these superiority claims.
Yes.
And if we can help people move from this kind of insecure intellectual understanding that, you know, that they've got the one right religion and they've got spirituality figured out, to help them have experiences that fulfill them, you know, then I don't think we'll have as much of sort of this fundamentalist absurdity. And so that's the hope, in a way, of, you know, psychedelic experiences being integrated and mainstreamed into our culture, available for those people that want them without the incredible legal prohibitions that we have, is that people can move into kind of a deeper, more personal, direct relationship with their own spirituality, and we can end up reducing a lot of these fundamentalist conflicts. And in fact, this idea that people who are fundamentalists are more similar to fundamentalists in other religions than they are to the sort of mystics and the spiritual people in their own religion.
Yes. Yeah, that's very true. You know, Rick, I don't know very much about the origin or the development of MDMA. Could you give us a little story about the man, you know, not necessarily about the man so much, but about his process in developing it? You know, how conscious of a process was it? And, you know, that sort of thing.
So you mean, in a way, Sasha Shulgin?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's this interesting part, which is that most people are not aware that MDMA was first developed in 1912 by Merck Pharmaceutical Company. And they didn't know what they had. They just...
What were they
were
doing
making,
that they made it? Were they trying to do something else, or...?
Yeah, it was a chemical intermediary between one of the other drugs that they were more interested in looking at. And so they just happened to patent everything they developed along the way. And this was a German pharmaceutical company. It was right prior to, you know, World War One. And what happened was that MDMA was developed in 1912, patented in 1914, and people have gone back and looked at the records, and they did absolutely nothing with it. They didn't test it in animals. They didn't test it in humans. It just was lost and forgotten. Then the next time we see it is in the early 1950s, and this is in the U.S. Army Chemical Warfare Service, where they were looking for mind control drugs and different ways to try to do non-lethal incapacitants, they would call it, like the humane warfare, where you didn't kill people, you just kind of deranged them for, you know, temporary periods
so
of time.
That's so kind.
And so this was used in a series of animal toxicity studies. And MDMA is kind of chemically halfway between mescaline, which is the active ingredient in peyote, and methamphetamine, which is speed. But MDMA, being sort of in the middle of this spectrum, you know, is unique. It's not like methamphetamine, and it doesn't make you jittery and constant energy. You can be quite peaceful, but you're alert, and it keeps you awake. And it's not quite like peyote, like mescaline, which, you know, has all sorts of visions, things like that. So the Army did some animal toxicity studies, but that was classified. And it wasn't released in public until the early 1970s. I think it was 1972 when it was published. And so what was happening during the 60s was an independent development of a drug called MDA, methylene dioxyamphetamine, MDMA being methylene dioxymethamphetamine. And MDA was really popular in the 60s, and it was, again, it's slightly more psychedelic than MDMA, a little bit more visual, a little bit stronger in some ways, but it was criminalized in 1970. And so then what we had was a series of laws that were based on criminalizing specific drugs. And chemists were able to tinker with the molecular structure of those drugs and create ones that were legal, that were not identical structurally.
Sure,
that,
yes.
That has since changed in that in 1986, the DEA helped get passed a law that criminalized analogs, so that if something is similar in structure and effect to something that's already illegal, it's also then supposedly illegal. So they criminalized whole classes of things before they were even invented.
Right. Rick, what and who do you believe and why is behind the quick, as soon as they could, criminalize it?
Well, I think it's all of us in a sense, that we have a society that is, you know, and many of us are scared of losing control. There's these desires, these passions, these irrational energies, and, you know, they're both providing us with the energy of life, but they're also really destructive. So, you know, we sort of have set up society and rules to kind of be a counterbalance to these irrational passions and desires. And so in terms of drug policy, you know, the majority of people still do support prohibition, although that's changing a lot, but still there is that sort of majority fear of losing control. And so I think that, you know, specifically what we had with MDMA, when it was coming out, what happened was that, you know, independent chemists had manufactured MDMA, and Sasha Shulgin had been, since the 60s, devoting himself to developing and understanding consciousness through creating all sorts of new psychedelic drugs. He'd been a star performer for Dow Chemical. He'd invented one of their insecticides. They gave him free rein to run a lab to do whatever he wanted. He started focusing on consciousness, and eventually he decided it's probably better for him to do that outside of Dow. They decided that as well. But he was told by a graduate student about MDMA. He'd been doing molecules similar to it. He manufactured it. He tried it. He felt that it had incredible potential. And he had a small test group of people, 12 people, that he would work with to evaluate new drugs that he would develop. And then this group felt that MDMA had substantial therapeutic potential. And then it went from this small group out to this team of underground psychedelic therapists and psychiatrists, particularly a fellow named Leo Zeff, who's been called the secret chief. And MAPS has published a book that's available on our website, you know, maps.org, about the secret chief and how he led and developed and trained hundreds of psychiatrists and psychologists how to use MDMA and other psychedelics.
We'll continue next week with Rick Doblin. In the meanwhile, you can search him out at maps.org. And for any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.